I was just looking at it. It's fine.
So as you said, I'm Mark Chu Carroll from Google. And I'm going to be telling you a bit about Go, as much as you can in a fairly short period of time. Excuse me. It's allergy season, so I apologize for strange noises. So, you know, you always have to start, before you do anything else, with a good old hello world. Part of what makes Go really interesting is it has threading embedded in it, concurrency in a very deep way. And so I figured I should just work that in right from the start. So what you can see in here is a function which uses a communication channel. And it sends a string to that channel. The main program starts that up down here, because go means launch it as it's basically a thread. I'll get into some details about that later. It's somewhat like more lightweight than a typical thread.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I can try and step back a bit to get the microphone. I hope I'm not blocking anyone's view. You have one routine that's sending a string to a channel. You have a second routine here at the bottom, which is pulling from a channel and printing it. So it's just, you know, a trivial example. So before I get into that, I just want to say a couple of things up front. I do work for Google. I am not officially representing them here. I'm going to say some very opinionated things, some of which people at Google would definitely not agree with. And I'm not really trying to teach you Go. That's more than anyone can do in 1 hour. What I'm trying to do is show you that this is a really interesting language, and it's worth the time and trouble of at least doing some experiments with it, if not using for real work. And it is definitely something that you should consider for real work. So to begin with, you know, the guys who wrote Go, they're all out in Massachusetts, they're not New Yorkers, which is why I'm the one giving you this talk. But you know, the idea that they had when they started, the reason that they started this, was, you know, at Google, most of our development is C++, and it causes us a whole lot of grief. Everyone is familiar with that. But yeah, one of the fundamental things was just, when you look at a C++ program, if you don't know enough about everything you include, you don't know what your program does. You can't. And they really hated that. Ron Pike in particular, who is the main language designer, really hated that. So he wanted a language where it does what you tell it to, nothing is invisible, and everything should be obvious. Another really important point, especially at Google, was fast compilation. And that sometimes sounds silly to people, but in the kind of environment that we have, we reuse so much code. My system, which is, I would say, smaller than average for Google, takes about 7 minutes to compile a first change. In Go, I could do a non-incremental full build of my system, if it were written in Go, in 8 to 7. And I mean, that's a big deal, and it's ridiculous that with fast bond machines, we can be so slow about compiling. People have gotten very lazy, and they really wanted to change that. They thought testing was something that should just be part of the language. There's no reason to have a separate testing framework. It should just be part of the infrastructure. So they put it right in. They wanted to be able to do objects. I can put it, I say it has objects and methods. I do not say it has object orientation. You'll see details about that later, but it has a very interesting version of objects. Very different from what you're used to in most object-oriented systems. And personally, I think it's beautiful, but it's definitely different. Once they were doing this, they also wanted to pull in just some, you know, common modern infrastructure. Again, as language primitive, it's not a bad. They wanted garbage collection. They wanted threads. They wanted strong types without a lot of work for the programmer. They wanted strong modules instead of know, include bonds and nonsense like that. So this is what declarations look like in a GO program. Every declaration starts with a keyword identifying the type of declaration. So you'll see cost, type, func, var, cost, item cost. Right? So it's always declaration type, followed by the identifier, followed by the value. So, you know, first, because the constant declaration is exactly what you expect. You could have a type in there if you wanted to, right where I just put that pointer. For constants in general, it can infer the type. There's no reason to type a type. No reason to write a type if you don't have to. Everything in Go is built around packages. Every source file starts with a package declaration. But a package is not a source file. You can and typically do split a package into lots of source files. You do have to compile all of them together. You have separate compilation in the sense of compiling packages separately. Each package can be compiled by itself in the moment. All of the source files that make up a package have to be together. And here's where you get to one of the sort of interesting things that you're going to see running through Go as a theme. Rob Pike, again, the primary designer of Go, is very, very into minimalism. He doesn't like typing. So he believes in trying to make it as much simplistic as possible. So within a package, or a structure, or anything else, if something starts with an uppercase letter, it's public. If it doesn't start with an uppercase letter, it's private. When I first saw that, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. After writing some Go code, I actually had time to appreciate it. Because when you look at a piece of Go code, client code, you don't need to know about what's public and what's private. You can tell just at a glance at a call site whether something is called in the public method or not. And private just means private to the package. Within a package, everything is open. So you have the usual suite of built-in types, but you have some interesting things too. You have complex numbers. They're built in as primitives right from the start. You have a map type built in. That's a key to value map. It is typed, so you declare the key type and the value type. You have arrays, which are not very useful in Go, and you have these things called splices, which will take the place of what we typically do arrays. And I'll say a little bit about that later. And of course, you have communication channels, because again, multi-threading is a fundamental thing in Go. In general, when you look at a Go program, everything is cached by value, except the built-in types, maps, slices, channels. They're all by reference. I feel I was going to say some negative things in here that they wouldn't agree with. This drives me up a tree. They very frequently in Go find language features that are necessary for them when they're writing new language, but they're not necessary for you, the learning program you're using language. This is an example of that. But there are pointers, so that becomes not an issue for the most part. There are structs, they're very similar to what we see in C++. The declaration order is different. In Go, types always come after names. This is defining a sort of list-like cons list. The car, the head of the list, is a string, the tail is a pointer to a cons list. So the pointers look pretty much like they would in C. You can declare types as aliases, so you can say, for instance, my int is an int 32. One of the interesting things about that is that really is defining a new type. I'm sorry?
It's not like a type.
No, it's not. To assign, we just defined mind as an 32, to assign an integer to a variable whose type is mind, you have to use a type conversion.
So overloading works with different types of
aliases. Yeah. Excuse me. Some of the code in this slide is a bit old. So that semicolon. Semicolons are no longer mandatory. No, they were when it first came out. They figured out how to get rid of them most of the time. So you can include them. There's no harm in it, but no noise. So again, Rob doesn't like to type speed. If you can figure out where the semicolon belongs by looking at the code, if it's really redundant, why type it? Because we have pointers, they look roughly like you would see them in C. You can take pointer values with ampersands, just like you would in C. One interesting little bit here is that there's no dot versus arrow for you referencing a pointer versus a value, a struct pointer versus a struct value. They're both dots. It's a strongly typed language, so you know whether it's a pointer or not. So there's no reason syntactically to distinguish. And it turns into a very useful ambiguity in some code. Because you can write methods that operate by value, or you can write methods that operate on pointers. And when you look at a method, it doesn't really matter for the most part, and so you write them the same way. So here's what functions would like to go. Again, always start with a keyword. It's public, so it starts with a capital letter. It's got a type declaration. The return type of the function comes at the end. And there are no parens around the conditions in if. Again, Rob doesn't like to type. That's going to be a very common theme in an awful lot of things about the language. But it's a very straightforward thing. You know, this kind of stuff is mostly very straightforward C-like language. So that first thing is just an absolutely classic recursive factorial function.
Okay, the curl is required.
I'm sorry?
Are the curly braces required?
Yes.
Can you repeat the question?
I'm sorry. He asked if the curly braces are required. Yes, they are. A lot of things in Go also just follow from Google standard coding conventions. And within Google, we always use braces. We never use a short if because we let it code against the errors. So they just encoded it as a rule in the language. So in conditionals, it loops, all sorts of things, the braces are mandatory. The second function is called Fibonacci. The interesting thing there is that it's showing switch. Switch in Go is much more flexible than and very different from C. Switch is essentially a multi-way conditional. It's in a lot of ways a lot more like a list count than like a C switch. So in the cases in a switch, there is no break, there is no fall through. At the end of the case, it automatically does the equivalent of a break. You do not, in this one, there is a value on the switch. You don't have to have that. You could just say switch open brace, and then inside of it say case n equals 0, case n equals 1, etc. So it is a very useful thing. And in fact, it could easily be the only conditional in the language if you wanted it to be, because that is the whole thing. this is another function. This returns both the maximum and the minimum values from an array of integers. So you can in Go, you can have multiple return values. It is not tuples like Python. So in every context in which you call this function, you have to provide two places to put the values. Put those return values. But you can return as many values from a function as you want. You can name return variables. So in this, you can see the return statement is completely empty. If you name your return values, you don't need to put them down in the return statement. So the names of your return values are just variables that you can assign to in the module function. And when you invoke return, it'll return whatever the latest value of those is. The other interesting thing in here is In Go, there's only one loop construct. There's no for, while, do, whatever. There's just for. But for comes in a bunch of different forms. So this one is an iteration form. So it says basically iterate over the array n. And the iteration value is a pair. It's the index and the value at that index from the array. Since we don't care, there's no use for the index within the array. So we don't want to use it. Declaring a variable without using it is an error in Go. So that underscore is just a way of saying, I don't care about this value, so discard it. So you don't have to put a variable in, but you do have to put a marker in the position. The colon equals is a shorthand. Mark doesn't like this type. But basically, any place where the type of the variable can just be determined by typing terms and context, you can say name colon equals value, and it will declare the variable, give it the type of the expression, and initialize it. So in most Go code, you don't really see var very much, far as how you would declare a variable normally. You usually see this colon equals form. Yeah.
Does it figure out the if you try to return and initialize the return value?
Yes, it does. All variables must be initialized and referenced in a Go program. So the return values are implicitly referenced by the return statement.
Yeah.
So the reference is taken care of, but no variable can be referenced until it has been initialized. No, it is not initialized to any default value. It's in an uninitialized state until you put a value on it. So a Go program that doesn't assign a value to the main return of a function will be rejected by the compiler. It will generate an error. So there are higher order functions. You can pass a function inside of a parameter to another function. The type, this is highlighted on the slide, but not showing on the projector, so see. That doesn't work either. Okay, well, the any little part in there is a function type. Says it's a function, the parameter type is any, the return type is bool. Any is declared right above it. That interface with empty braces, I will explain later, but essentially you can go, every value that you could possibly create always matches the interface empty. So it really isn't any. And just as an interesting side note, you see in here there's another range over an iterator. That in Go actually involves concurrency and communication between the tabs. It really is pervasive in the language. Even iteration over data structures is done using threads and concurrency and communication.
So, would you consider that a fundamental goal to the design of the language?
Yes, absolutely.
And so, as the scaling and performance been characterized across real architectures?
Yes. These threads are actually called Go routines. They're called Go routines. And a Go routine is not a native thread. It is a Go runtime structure, which is by Go multiplexed onto the native thread. The overhead for a Go routine is, I believe, currently down to 512 bytes in memory. And in terms of CPU or threads or anything like that, it will multiplex onto the smallest number of threads that it absolutely needs. People write Go programs that use hundreds of Go routines and don't see any performance issues with it because of the way that the runtime multiplexes it.
Are the issues of concurrent multiplexing of these things and exclusivity of those semantics well-defined and controllable?
Exclusivity, there isn't any. The way that Go tries to do that, again, the idea was to try and make the semantics as simple as possible. So it is, under normal conditions, it is fully shared memory, no locks. But it's up to the programmer to be safe about it. But the way that it generally handles it is, in a Go routine implementation, you generally only reference local variables, and you communicate with other threads, other Go routines, exclusively through communication channels. So you don't rely on variables for sharing information between Go routines. You rely on channels, and channels are completely synchronized. You can get around. So you can provide any kind of concurrency system you want to in terms of the channels. And they have, in Go library, they have mutexes and critical sections and locks. And, you know, every concurrency mechanism that you would typically see in a thread library, they're implemented for Go routines, and the underlying implementation is communication channels. It works out in the end. But you can do stupid things that will have disastrous results. Don't try to protect you from yourself. If you want to do something stupid with the Go routine, you can do something stupid with the Go routine, and you won't control it.
I missed the beginning of your presentation. Is this genealogy instead of things like Plan 9 or Inferno?
Yes.
Or Limbaugh or other?
Yes. The guys who are building this are formerly the Plan 9 group for Bell Labs. This is a direct follow-on to Limbo. Is that the language? I always forget which was the language and which was the runtime. So it's a direct follow-on of Limbo and another language that was it. Communication. Now, the terminal with the OS. Something called it. I don't remember, honestly. But it's a direct follow-on of the formula. So the language is really designed by Bob Strong, who is the Plan 9 and Inferno guy from the last. The Go compiler was implemented by Fine Mark Tedeschi's it was implemented by Dennis Ritchie and Russ Cox, who, Unix people all know about them. He's very much in that lineage. Okay. Getting to objects and methods. In Go, a method is a function that has a prefix argument, which is called the discriminator. So this thing up here is declaring a method on type pointer to const list. You can declare a method on any type that you want. If that type is important, a method on a pointer to a const list is a different thing than a method on a const list. You can only declare one of those two. For a given method name, you can declare the method on the pointer or on the concrete type, but not on both. That's a bit weird. I'm not fond of that, but that's the way to do it. You know it just exactly what you would kind of expect from an object implementation. If you've seen the language overwrite, this is very much like overwrite. You can declare a method on any type on all, as long as you're in the package where the type is declared. So here I can declare a number, which is a sort of weird version of an integer. A number is a unit 32, and I'm sorry, integer, there are no negative numbers. And then I can implement a method on basically an integer. Methods are not constrained to structs, objects, pointers. You can declare a method on anything as long as you're in the package for the type is declared. Just very briefly, arrays in Go are weird. Arrays of two different sizes are two different types. They are not interchangeable, they are not interoperable, they are in fact not compatible in any way, shape, or form. And they're passed by value. which is obviously very expensive. And subscripting does not work according to a race, nothing. A race can go really soft. But there is this thing called a slice. A slice is essentially a clever little wrapper around an array. It's passed exclusively by reference. You cannot pass a slice by one in. It contains a bunch of meta information about the slice, and slices of different sized arrays are compatible. So why do they have both arrays and slices? Why aren't slices just the arrays? You haven't found out. This is a very strange thing. But you can do a slice literal. You put the array brackets in front of the type name, open brace after it in a list of values, and there's your slice. You can splice ranges out of a slice. It really looks very, they're really, slices are great. Yes?
Do the slices have to be the same size?
No.
Okay.
No. The size of the slice is a one-time thing, not a stack. Yes?
In terms of arrays in Go versus arrays in C, mm-hmm. sort of a qualitative question, you'd approach C to, for instance, if you're going to do low-level bit splitting for imaging or something like that. Mm-hmm. Is there any characterization of array performance in Go compared to C if you wanted to do something as low-level as blitting or scaling or something in imaging?
Yes. You can... an array in Go is exactly an array in C. With the exception that it does bounce check. You can declare a module in Go, or a packet, I'm sorry, in Go, as being unsafe. If it's unsafe, all the checking goes away.
So that overhead is incurred if you don't have that?
Right, so if you're not using if you're not using an unsafe package, then arrays include bounce checking if the compiler can't statically determine it. So for instance, if you do a loop, you know, for I in range of array, there's no type check, there's no bounce check, no reason to. Any context in which it can, by any static method, figure out that the bounce check isn't necessary, it's gone. So if you're writing numerical code, going into matrices, you don't, in general, you don't need bounce checking, it will not generate.
But the corollary to that, is there any comparison with respect to performance at this stage? You know, GCC's output for doing matrices or vector-vector products versus Go's performance.
Okay. Well, there are two different Go compilers right now. There's one, what do you call it numerically? XG.
6G?
Well, it's in Plan 9 style, the way that they name things is there is a numeric prefix for each processor. And so, you know, on an Intel machine, the numeric prefix is 6. So the Go compiler is 6G on an Intel. On a, the processors that are typically in cell phones these days.
ARMs?
Yes. The ARMs are 3s, so 3G. And so on. So the generic is XG. So there's the XG compiler, which is unbelievably fast in terms of the compilation time. Its code is typically about twice as slow as C. On array intensive, if it needs bounds checking, it is significantly worse than that. I honestly don't know the current feature. I haven't done that. I've heard it much lately. GCC, and then there's a second Go compiler, GCC Go, and uses the GCC backend. So if it doesn't need bounds checking, it's exactly the same code generated as it would be for C++ on that array. So you're going to see exactly the same performance, both the good and the bad aspects of that kind of performance. Any other questions? Anyway, so now we're going to get to where Go starts getting pretty cool. This is one of the things I absolutely love about programming in Go. If you use Python or something like that, you hopefully hopefully had heard of duck typing. Duck typing, the name of it comes from, if it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, well then it's a duck. Go implements statically checked duck typing using these interfaces. And it is a joy to use. Basically, you declare these things called interfaces. An interface is a set of methods. Any object that implements that set of methods is an instance of a type. If it has the methods declared in an interface, it is that it is a member of that interface. So, for example, there's an interface in the standard Go library called stringer. A stringer is a value that knows how to convert itself to a string. If you implement a method, a public method named string with no parameters that returns a string value, well, you're an implementation of a stringer. And anything in the library, anything in Go that takes advantage of objects that can render themselves as strings, it automatically accepts it. So this is a little bit mind-blowing to some people because it seems like it's one around the static type system. It's just really a very different version of the static type system. So I didn't want to just keep talking features like this because that gets really boring. So I decided to walk you through a non-trivial example. This is the first substantial thing I wrote in Go, and I have used it a ridiculous amount since then. It's called combinator parsing. In combinator parsing, the idea is to have something kind of sort of vaguely like less than yak, only without less than deck. So there's no external tool. Your code, the code you write, is the parser, but it has an awful lot of the properties of a grammar-based parser. So just for example, here we have a real simple grammar, sort of simple version of a LISPEC expression. You have an open paren followed by a closed paren, or you have an identifier. And it's recursive in there. So you can do this in terms of combinators. You declare a left paren, which is a parser that parses a single character, a left paren. With our paren, you have an identifier which parses many of whatever char parser does, the one meaning at least one. So this is the equivalent of this set of characters with a plus after it in the standard DNS grammar. In order to build recursive rules, you have to declare a reference thing, which is just an interact. Alt is the equivalent of the bars in Yak. So you can have alt of, it'll be either this or this. And there's a sequence constructor that says this followed by that, and so on. So to do this in Go, we first declare an input type. Anything that can say this is the character at this position, and that can say this is how big I am, that's an input to a parser. A parse value is a value returned by a successful parse. It can be anything. So a parser then is something which takes an input and takes a starting position within that, and it starts parsing characters at that position. It returns three values. One, which is a boolean, which says whether or not the parse was successful. A length, which tells you how many characters it matched in its best parse. And a result that length. So for a parser input, let me just start by going to what we have here. So we have a string parser input, which is a struct with one field, which is a string. The methods on it are pretty straightforward. This is the way that a naive Go programmer would write this. This is not the right way of writing this. In fact, the right way of writing this would be just to say type string parser input string. There is absolutely no reason to have that struct. You can declare your own string type and write methods on it. So that struct is just an unnecessary wrapper. So any questions about this much? So the simplest parser and the combinator is one that parses one character from a specific set. So there's the declaration of it. And again, whether you really want to have structure here or not is a little bit iffy. In this case, I would argue that we should. Basically, for debugging purposes, it would be useful if you don't have. And the constructor. So in Go, you don't get to declare constructors to type the way that you would in C or C++. You can say new of type of anything and get a new instance of it, and it will be uninitialized. You're uninitializing if you do that. So you typically write functions that create an instance, but they don't have to have any specific name. You can name them whatever makes sense. So in this, I'm trying to make it look sort of like an specific language, so charset. It's the constructor for charset parser. So the way that it actually parses, you have a declaration, and it looks through a sequence of acceptable characters, the things that will parse. If it finds the current input character in them, it succeeds, and it returns that character, and that's it. If it doesn't, it will end up returning false. first combinator that you typically look at is many, which basically is a repetition of something else. Many will do repetition of anything. It doesn't have to just be it doesn't have to be just charset. But this is what the type would look like, the minimum number of occurrences that it needs to find in order to be successful, and the thing that it wants to parse repeatedly. And these are sort of, this is an example of how you can use it. If you want to get rid of white spaces as your parser, you declare a space character as a character parser, and then white spaces, lots of spaces. Choices, again, very much the same idea. The alternatives are the parsers. Again, the struct isn't really necessary. You can have it if you want. You don't have to. You can code that straight away. But it is useful for debugging. And the implication is a little bit more interesting here. So we start off by just initializing return values. And then we try each parser in succession until either one of them succeeds or we run out. One sort of interesting thing about this is that this is actually a backtracking parser. The reason is when it starts running one of those alternatives, it will run it forwards as far as it possibly can until it finds either success or it completely fails. So it might end up parsing way ahead, generating sub-parse trees, etc. But when it gets back in here and it fails, it will end up failing and throwing away all the intermediate values that it generated. So you actually have to be very careful in this kind of thing about side effects. So that the parse actions are going to happen whether they end up being successful or not. So here are a couple of examples of parsers that you can find. Just for what we have so far. Of course, there's no good without actions. So we declare an action type. An action is an interface, which is something that's executable on a parse value using another parse value. And that's it. So that the implementation of a parse action, it runs the actual parser. If it succeeds, it calls the action, the result from that parser, and then returns that. So all it does is replace the return value. There are a lot of combinators that we use to build something real. You want sequencing, you need referencing. If card is an action, it just throws away the result of a parse. So for instance, in that white space, you don't want to return anything to white space, so you throw it away. Nth returns over a sequence. The sequence automatically returns a list of values. and it returns one of them. Token is kind of a nice little thing which basically says return n, the second value, result of sequence parser on spaces followed by something. So that essentially parses a token, possibly with UD spaces, and throws away the UD spaces. And these are a couple of examples of how you would actually find tokens. Often in various digits, letters. This is building up the chords here. That example I started with the list conquest. If you wanted to return a list by a list, so there's a symbol, so there's an action that generates symbols, actually special parts. And so we have tokens for parsing a symbol. Tokens are shorthand in here for the leading space thing I mentioned before. So we have left paren, right paren, and symbol are the three token types. Boy, this looks much better on my screen reader's color. The real body of this is this. So we start with a reference. We have an action wrapped around many expressions, many S expressions, at least one. And then use that inside of here. So the way to actually parse a real S expression is it's going to be, it's an alt, so it's a choice of either this or this. List parser is left paren, a bunch of expressions, right paren, and symbol is symbol. And this is just setting up the references for a recursive rule. And then you can just run it on the list, and it will return your little consoles. Any questions on the methods and interfaces and all that stuff that I just breezed through at light speed? Are you all just too confused to ask questions? Or? Okay.
What's a thread? See, I'm joking. I came in late, but if it's too insulting a question or too boring an answer, just skip it.
Well, a thread is a concurrent path of control. So you have multiple processors on your machine, you can do multiple things at the same time. Threads are the programming abstraction of things that can occur at the same time.
What about, you have two threads.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some concept of a variable having a value which is held in a location? Could the two different threads, once they've been spawned, can they possibly, without formality, can they just grab and look or change something?
They can.
Oh my God. How can you allow this? I thought this was an advance on C.
To be honest, I sort of agree with you. I would rather that they had not done shared memory. But their idea was to make it as easy to code as possible.
I
actually had this argument with Rob about it, and when he presented this in New York. And his idea is, this is a systems language. We're not here to protect you from yourself. So if you want to do something, go ahead and you're not going to stop it. But for the most part, the way that you're encouraged to program is there are these beautiful things called go routines, and there are these beautiful communication channels are synchronized and have great behavior and great well-defined semantics, and by God, use them. And that will take care of it. This is a very half-assed answer.
Can you throw a switch and say, no ridiculous threads, must only this compilation will only recognize in the source code these go routines and such. Like, there's no switch yet.
Well, there is. Go routines are the only threads in Go.
Oh, okay.
But a go routine can access any variable.
Okay.
Variables is fully shared memory. Variables are shared. Values are shared. You can have pointers for the same thing and do little variable games, bunge away, and you know, the semantics are undefined if you do that.
Right.
Yes.
Excuse me. Are the semantics of Go routines enforced with locality the way threads are, or are there any inherent mechanisms or library level mechanisms for distributed computing across multiple nodes in a cluster?
Go is not designed for multiple nodes across a cluster. So the Go routines are strictly within a shared memory unit. So there are libraries with remote procedure call systems that try to expand across that. And there are library implementations that give you the illusion of channels that span across processes on different machines. But they are not native. They're not quite the same. It is still, essentially a single computer language for writing programs that run on the machine. You can have lots of processors and you can multiplex code routines across them, but not across multiple machines.
Is the scheduling then tied to the runtime? I mean,
yes.
So because the notion, for instance, let's say if you were to say generic Linux boxes, my understanding is that pthreads essentially sits on top of the clone calls. It's a lighter invocation, but it's essentially, for all intents and purposes, very similar to a fork. So scheduling is deferred to whatever affinities or high-level calls that are set in terms of threading. But basically, the OS is doing an awful lot of the bookkeeping. You're suggesting?
Well, it's a little bit tricky.
With respect to Go or with respect to threads?
With respect to, threads tend to be a mess. Threads just tend to get complicated. Because they're linked so differently in different places. And then there are like three different threads implementations for Linux these days, depending on which flags you pick when you compile the kernel. But what Go does is it has its schedule sitting on top of the OS. So Go's scheduler has a pool of threads. That's part of the Go runtime. Go will assign a Go routine into a processor thread, or even the OS thread, and start it. And when that thread gets preempted for some reason, the next time the Go scheduler runs it, it may drop it on top of the different thread. You can have 100 Go routines, and if your program has the right properties, two OS threads. It does the multiplexing on top of them. So you're not getting all of them. When you spawn a Go routine, you are not getting all of the overhead of an OS thread. You don't have to worry about that, at least. And the semantics of Go routines are consistent no matter what implementation of OS threads is actually going to be used by the runtime. So it does give you a consistent thread system, a consistent, lightweight thread system where you really don't have to worry about creating the threads. Most of the stuff on here. The way that you launch Go routine is just by putting the keyword Go in front of any function call. So just as an example of this, almost everyone has heard of the civil Saturdays, which is a method of generating primes. You have the way that we do this in Go is you have a generator, which is a Go routine which generates your sequence of numbers. Then you create a filter with a parameter, which is the first prime number. Out goes that prime number and it strips out every multiple. And the first input to the next one is 3, so it's a filter of 3, the most multiples of 3, etc. So the way you do this in Go is you write first a generate function. It takes as its parameter a channel which is used to communicate integers. And it just runs a loop which sends to the channel the integer values in sequence. And then you have filters which do basically what I was just saying. So the filter takes two channels, one input, one output. And it returns one prime number. Takes one prime number, which is the number it's filtered on. It runs a loop, it reads a value from the input. If it doesn't divide that evenly, it writes it to the output. So you look again, you run the main function, create an initial channel, you start your generator and have it write the integers to that channel. Then you read the first value from that, that's a prime number. Print it out, start making a new channel, and you start a filter from that original channel that the generator is running on, as the input, new channel as the output, and have a filter on times. Now you set your input channel to be the output from the most recently created filter. So after one iteration of this, you'll have a generate coroutine, and you'll have one filter coroutine. And then next time you'll have two filters, and your channel will be the generate to the first filter to the second filter, and so on. Each time we'll just generate another coroutine. And that's it, that's your SIBs. You end up in Go using Go routines constantly for everything. There's no exception handling in Go, none at all. The way that you typically get around that is you take code that may have an error, you wrap it in a Go routine, and that Go routine has two channels that it could use to communicate a result. One of them is if it's successful, one of them is the error if it fails. And then you put a select. Here's the successful result, here's the error result. You just use Go routines and channels. If you programmed in Lua, this is very much like the way you can when I was in Lua. Iterators, I showed you an iterator loop before. I'm sorry, yes?
The exception handling is like, why make that Go routine instead of just a function that returns two values?
Basically, because what you could do in the Go routine is signal the error to the parent process to know that something went wrong, and then go off and do some cleanups. So you have your cleanups in your, you know, in your own Go routine. Go routine cleans up after itself. You try not to do shared memory. So it can do the cleanup, and it signals the parent thread as soon as it possibly can. Iterators, you just create a channel, you read the values from the channel, eventually the channel closes, and then you have to read it, fails, and the iteration.
I'm curious, this fellow Pike shared with you the concurrency, the control level concurrency that's happening here. Is it inspired by a particular classical paradigm like communicating sequential processes? Or
This is very much. It's based on an extension of CSP. So your CSP has a static set of channels. This is fully synchronized channels that behave exactly like CSP channels, but you can dynamically create and interconnect them. My background, I did a PhD on parallels programming where I used a model based on PyCalculus. I see it as being very PyCalculus. But most people don't know about PyCalculus, which is a shame, it's kind of fun. Iterators, like I said, if you call range of a channel, it will rebound from the channel until it fails. And so that's the way that you do the range in here. There are a bunch of weird things in language. Here's where I get really critical. These are the things that I really hate about Go. There's no exception handling except for them, there's exception handling. For various buildings where they wanted to be able to have an error that you could catch without crashing your program, they added this optional kind of okay parameter. So when you try and access a field of a variable, If you have comma okay, that will always succeed, but if you went beyond the array bounds or you practice the key of a table of a map that isn't there, okay gets set to true. This works for tasks, this works for array accesses, it works all over the place. And the comma okay is optional. You have the choice of either program crashes if I access the wrong thing or I get a flag. You can't do that. When you're writing code, you don't get to do that. You can put a comma okay, at least mandatory. There is this fundamental asymmetry in types. There are some types that are built by Go, that are passed by records, that have parametric types, type parameters on your maps and whatever. You don't get to do that. That's only for the code implementers. And you get some real ugliness in the language as a result. So everything in Go you make with new, except the built-in types, which you can't make with them because new doesn't make the right parameters. So there's a new and there's make. And some things you make and some things you new. That is really ugly. Rob has a thing about minimalism that sometimes really gets ugly. So he didn't want to put enumerated types in the language. But people really wanted enumerated types. So he came up with this thing called IOTA. IOTA is a magic variable. Every time you access IOTA in a statement, it increments by one. So in a const clause, the first time you call IOTA, you get a zero. Next time you use IOTA, you get a 1. The next time you use IOTA, you get a 2. And so you have enumerated types implemented in the ugliest way I have ever seen. This is atrocious. And there are all sorts of clever things that Rob has worked out to do with this. You can use IOTA in an expression. So he has this example he loves where he has you define, you know, K, megabyte, gigabyte, whatever, by having IOTAs multiplied by thousands. This might be a thing now. I've been using both for almost a year now, and I still haven't decided whether I like this or not. There is no inheritance in Go. You can define essentially objects with methods. You cannot define subclass. There is no subclass in Go. What you can do is if you put a field inside of a struct, and you don't give it a name, then its fields appear as the fields of the structure that encodes. So here in pipe U, this will have fields X, Y, and Z. Looks like inheritance. If you call one of the keys method on U, you are invoking it only on this unnamed field. You are not invoking it on the U. You are invoking it on the unnamed key field of U. Which is really weird. In terms of interfaces, when you do this inside of an interface, you can put another interface name inside of an interface. It's essentially interface inheritance. But this is... it's lightweight. It avoids some of the weird semantics that you get in a lot of object systems, but it's pretty wonky. The stuff that I didn't really tell you about, the fact that you might want to look at if you think Go is interesting, I didn't say immediately about slices. Slices are really cool. If you just pretend that slices are the arrays in Go, you'll be happy, they're beautiful. I didn't tell you much of anything about how that composition thing works, because frankly, I could talk for an hour and probably still don't understand it because it doesn't make any sense. There is a phenomenal set of libraries for Go. On this, they really went all out. I mean, you name something where you want a library, and by God, they have provided a beautifully written, well-optimized library for it. Seriously, I have yet to find, you know, something that is a generic functionality that I would want that isn't there. And the implementations are good. The tools for Go are beautiful. They've got a very nice debugger, a very nice profiler. They've got their own versions of GAC and Lex. There's a testing tool that uses built-in test stuff. There's a documentation generator. There's a formatter that gives that enforces the standard Go style and clean up the code for you. The tools are great. Testing is built into Go. I haven't told you anything about that. There is a foreign function interface for interfacing with C, and library is written in C. I haven't told you anything about that. There is no interface for interfacing with C++ code, and there's not likely to be one. C++ is just too complicated, and the implementations are too divergent for them to be able to realistically do that. So if you want to be able to link with C, you're going to have to build a C interface to the C++ to use that tool to Go. So for instance, there is a WX Windows library for Go, and it's implemented using WXC. So that's pretty much it. I hope I haven't bored you hopelessly. I do want to put these slides up where you can download them. I was going to put them on my blog, but due to some extreme weirdness that occurred this morning, my blog is moving, so I don't actually have a URL.
We can put it on the...
Okay, so I will send it. I'll send it to you as soon as I know where I'm land, where my blog is going to land.
Or you can just send us the slides. So
right.
We can upload it to you.
Okay. Yes.
That's kind of stupid questions. One, you said that the tool of debuggers, et cetera, fantastic. What about the actual compilers? What about actually living with the tools? Like thinking about this as somebody who may want to support this kind of thing. What's it like to actually live with all of the tools and the apps and all of this stuff on Unix systems?
The tools are built by guys who are hardcore Unix hackers. They are absolutely comfortable. Programming in Go is a delight. The tools work exactly the way that as a Unix programmer you would expect them to, and they are lightning fast.
What about working with the actual language itself? Is it working with, I end up working with compiling a lot of different languages for leading wild environments. With that stated, run into like some of the most surprising and fantastically terrible things just building the tools themselves, building the compiler, building the tools necessary to run the language. Do you have much experience with that, Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So, like I said, the guys who wrote it are hardcore Unix guys. So, any Unix-like system compilation build of the tools is very straightforward. God forbid you try and make this to non-Unix. It's been out for a year, they still don't really have a completely working Windows for it yet.
Sure.
If you have to work in different environments, they have ported to some really divergent uses. So, you can run a Go program on an iPad. Apple won't let you, but it's ported. You can run a Go program on an Android phone. You can run a Go program on an ARM netbook. You can run Go programs inside of the browser if you're using either Chrome or Chrome Train, using the native client. Anything that's at all Unix-like, it works very nice to have. But if you're not Unix, you're Unix.
Well, one other question about then the actual use of it. Coming into this completely new to Go, say we all work at Google, can we go get Go?
It's open source.
.org. You just go, do you want to get a BSD license? Okay.
I'm sorry?
It's a BSD license.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. So, it's open source, very flexible license.
What was Google's point, is my question. I know a little bit about some of the infrastructure at Google. I know some of the internal, to the extent I could know internal stuff, I know a little bit. But if it doesn't interact with C++, is it here's a scripting language that you guys can start using out there?
with our as an end user, or was there an internal function that was the point? I mean, that's what a little confused that.
Google was a very strange company. Google is...
So was all the Vista in 1999.
Google is it's a very engineering-driven company, and projects get started if there's a bunch of engineers who think it's a good idea. So Rob and his gang from Bell Labs thought this was a great idea, but they didn't. And now they're trying to get people inside of Google to use it. A big part of the goal behind it for them inside of Google was, you know, we have one code base, and that's it. Everything is in this one code base, which is glorious in some ways. But compilation times with a lot of code reuse can be absolutely mind-boggling. There are systems at Google that take hours to do a build, simply because the linkage is so complicated, and what really takes a long time is the linker. And the linker just goes and goes and goes for hours. We ended up writing our own linker trying to get around that, and it sped things up, but it went from 10 hours to 2 hours. So they really wanted to try and say, you know, C++ stinks, and most of us know that, and most of us hate it, even though we're stuck using it. So, and all a lot of this linkage problem comes from C++. If we're programming in C, these links would not be taking 2 hours. It's really a C++. So what they wanted to do was try and say, okay, here's an alternative way of doing it. We're not going to reuse all of that old Google code that's there. Because if we did, our compilations would be no faster than they are already. So, you know, for a new project, I believe we might want to be able to be fast and make their developers and engineers productive, they can use this. But we're not even going to try and attach it to the old infrastructure because it's a lost cause. So, you know, if that thing didn't work, well, there are projects at Google using Go. The company as a whole hasn't really made a decision about whether we want to use it long term. I hope we do. I think it's a lot of
internally for systems administration?
Internally for building applications.
It's like McDonald's doing a fish sandwich. I don't want to eat it, but... I mean, that's kind of thing with technology. You know what I mean?
And the Go team hopes that within, the Go team hopes that within some not very long period of time, large chunks of Google infrastructure will be built completely using Go. It's not intended to be a throwaway only for doing little things. It really is intended to be used by Google for great, big, complicated projects. And the hope was it would also be useful to people outside. Google has this real thing on open source. They really believe in giving back. So when they designed this language, there was never any question that it wasn't going to be open source. And it's not like, okay, before I was at Google, it was IBM. But IBM didn't want to support a project with open source yet. It was throwing it over the wall and discarding it. That is not what we're doing with Go. The Go team really, really wants to see it.
Well, Google sees it as a marketing opportunity as opposed to throwaway technology. That's right. That's the flip side. You just see it as throwaway, you see it as a marketing opportunity.
You know, honestly,
not in a negative way, but
honestly, I don't think so. I mean, again, Google is a weird company. It really is. It's nothing. Google doesn't open source things as a marketing scam. They do it as part of a genuine belief in giving back. We depend so much on open source. You know, everything we have is built on open. So if we can give something back, we do. And that's not just to get attention. As a fact, you know, for the most part, the attention that we've gotten from Google has been more negative than positive because people are convinced that it's part of some marketing scam.
I'm just wondering if perhaps you could give us a few minutes, if you have,
on any background. So, for example, when Unix was launched, when Steve was launched, right? So the first thing that happened was that the C compiler in Fortran, as soon as you could bootstrap the C compiler in C, you turned off Fortran. Mm-hmm. Fortran was developed for numerical computing.
Right.
Lisp ostensibly was developed as an expression of lambda calculus. Prolog was for logic programming. Occam was to tie transfuge together in CSP style. What would you say, or how would you characterize as the launch philosophy? There's got to be a little history for this, if it is a derivative of Plan 9 and Fernow and Limbo, etc.
So, I mean, the Go guys are very specific about that. They say it is a systems programming language. And by systems, they mean large software systems, large high-performance software systems. So the idea that it really is to build things like Google infrastructure. It's not particularly a great language for building, you know, user-facing UIs. It's not a great language for building user-facing UIs. There are, you know, there are much easier languages to build your UI in. But if you need to build infrastructure, you need to build a database, you need to build a web server, you need to build, you know, a network communication system, a network protocol, a text processing system, you know, of anything like that, deep systems, those are very rudimentary words. So that, I mean, that's really the idea.
So really it's meant in a sense to be a next generation. I mean, it's obvious that a team that includes people like Richie and Pike,
right,
you've got other Bell Labbers,
yeah,
it's really intended as a descendant and ostensibly at someday maybe a replacement for C.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
So for C or Python?
C.
C.
It is absolutely not intended to try and do Python.
Okay.
Because Python, I mean, the Go guys love Python, actually. And they use it because it's good for different things.
So, idiomatically and in terms of design goals, would you, again, try to characterize, other than what it's going to be used for, how are these, what are the constructs and sort of top-tier things other than fast link and a replacement for C? This is very abstract. If we talk about
Aquaman,
about
CSP. So I try to structure my talk around what I see as the two most important things in terms of how we use the building things, which are the interfaces and its version of objects and the Go regions. Those are the two things that really characterize how you program in Go and how Go is intended to be used. So, I mean, those are really and truly the heart of the language.
So one sounds like a concurrency. It's addressing the issue of control-level concurrency, right? And what would you say the other one is? Expressibility or narrowing the semantic gap? Or
expressibility. Yes.
Would you know or be able to say whether the web crawling software of Google is already on its way to being written in Go?
No, it is not.
And how about the indexing?
Right now, I am limited in what I can say in that for two different reasons. One is I don't work on it. And the other is I'm not really allowed to say very much because it is considered very proprietary. That stuff is written in C++. That's pretty well known. That stuff is enormously complicated. And
so that we're not a candidate for Go?
Not yet. Not until Go has, I mean, now I'm speaking completely off the cuff in my opinion. I do not know if this is what the research team thinks. Even if the research team thinks, I have not spoken to them about it. I know nothing. But I don't think that there was mature enough for anything that's quite that critical yet. So, you know, my last project that I left recently was doing log data analysis. And I did a little bit of a comment in Go. That is something where it's useful, it's great, and it proves that the language can work. I think it's going to need to prove itself on a lot of things like that before critical things like that are really going to be willing to risk their infrastructure on course. Which is going to take some time. Honestly, I think there's a good chance that long term that might happen. Because my experience programming in Go has been very positive. I mean, you know, I said a lot of critical things. There's been a lot of ugliness about various things in the language, but overall, it is a joy to program. It is just fun. It really is. It's fun, it's fast, it's effective, it's expressive. It's what I want for most of the stuff I have to write for work. So I think long term, there's a pretty good chance. But that's really long term. Yes?
So, Python Friends, 4.9, right. It's successive units, and that's kind of direct. I see a lot of reasons to other languages in Go. Do they write it conceiving that they would replace a particular language, or is it more catered to their usage pattern of various languages?
The latter.
Okay.
So, you know, it's...
So it's not looking to replace C++ outright, it's just...
No, I don't think that they believe there's any chance of just completely replacing C++ outright. I think the idea is to be an alternative, a better alternative that can really be used and that people will take seriously. You know, one of the things that Rob said the first time I saw him speak on it was, oh, there have been a lot of really cool languages that came out that were better than C++, that fit this niche, and that completely disappeared. And the reason that they disappeared more than anything else was they didn't have anyone behind them. Right? You know, Module 3, that was a gorgeous programming language. That was an absolutely gorgeous language. It crashed and burned because the only company that really backed it was DEC. And DEC, at the point that the language came out, was already irrelevant. So, you know, nobody believed that it was going to be there for them. Rob and company are hoping that the fact that it's Google, people, you know, the people don't think Google is going to disappear tomorrow. They're hoping that that is, you know, enough to give people the confidence to try it.
Any benchmarks been attempted using the Go routine paradigm concurrency for big data reduction jobs? I mean, if you're a log analysis guy, I get
data reduction. I mean, again, I'm talking in terms of Google. Data reduction in Google is something, you know, my job's one port ran. I left the project 2 weeks ago for something new. Run on 14,000 processes for 20 hours per day.
Okay. It's a great step for this concurrency, doesn't it?
No, it's not, because Go concurrency is single machine.
Right?
It's not cluster concurrency. So, you know, when I wrote code, it had to use standard RPC, just like C++ for the coordination stuff, for the reduces. So, you know, that doesn't give you a reasonable estimate of this kind of thing.
Okay, so there's a different price performance curve in the industry, which says that because we can't get transistor speeds up, we're doing things like throwing 12, 16, and 30 nodes inside of a NUMA box, right, or an SMP box. It very
that's
much sounds like
yes, this. That is what goes intended. But as a Googler, when I think about data reduction and things like that, I think the 14,000
is scale.
Yeah, the scale is completely different. So, you know, in terms of running concurrency on the multiprocessor CPU, that thing does lots of benchmarks and it did very well. But I can't really talk about how it works for, like I said, you know, data reduction things like that, because that's not, you know, nothing that I would write would do that with Go.
But if I may suggest, if the density of cores per machine goes up, you're going to at some point, you know, people are developing things like Fortress for doing, you know, like HPC for numerics. You're going to need a system-level parallel language. So the only reason I'm persisting with this line of query is I saw you had a reference to RPCs. And the fact is, you know, even if you write to MPI or something, it's a bitch to get a bunch of cores to do something really constructive.
Well, okay, that's not what Go was designed to do. And I'm not a member of the Go team.
Okay,
I have zero into it. And, you know, frankly, if you were designing a language for doing that, you would design a very different language. So, you know, and again, like I said, I come at this very much as someone, you know, engrossed in, submerged in network culture. We have really nice tools for doing, you know, multi-machine concurrency. You know, MapReduce and Friends are glorious. They're wonderful. They do a great job. They're fast. They have everything that we really want right now for doing that. And you know, as a company, we believe that that's the right way of doing it. And so that's what we try and do. So, you know, in terms of a language like Go, there will be a MapReduce interface in Go. There isn't yet, I don't think, I haven't really checked. So I shouldn't say that, but there even might be. But, you know, that's how we would do large-scale multi-machine concurrency. But for doing multi-cores within a single machine, even, you know, when you pop your hand up to maybe even a couple of hundred cores, those are good for that. So. Other questions? Yes?
Yes. Can you give us more details about the built-in testing?
I'm sorry?
About the built-in testing.
Okay, so it's a little bit of in some ways. But the basic idea is within a package, any source file whose name ends in _test is assumed to be a test unit. And there is a standard interface for testing that has essentially all of the normal asserts, checks, and whatever. And so, you know, it's just tests are just a function that takes a test object as a parameter. And, you know, do their thing and they succeed or fail. And then, you know, in terms of the Go tools, when you're doing a compile in Go, you say Go test instead of, you know, domain. And it compiles and it runs the test. And because it knows what the tests are because of this convention and the standard interface. So, you know, it's minimal. Again, this is Rampai, so everything is done in a very minimalistic way. But that's the job. It looks like JUnit, for example. I mean, it's very much that flavor. So. Any other questions? I mean, if you have...